So the last talk of this series on what is a Dhammachari. So we've been having a good look at the nature of ordination, the nature of the ordination ceremony, the Dhammachari ordination. In the first talk, I was one of the things I was trying to do was to really draw out how unique our ordination is, how unique Sangharakshita's vision of ordination is, and that led us to a discussion of the first of the acceptance verses that come towards the end of the public ordination ceremony. With loyalty to my teachers, I accept this ordination. And then we talked about the fact that as a Dhammachari, one of the things that we're working for within the order and, well, within the world is harmony. Really working to bring about a deeper and deeper harmony, deeper and deeper harmonizing between ourselves and others and between others, reconciling the divided, but also moving to deeper levels of harmony. I ended that talk with that poem of Bhante's, the Golden Flower. And that was really a discussion of the second of the acceptance verses, in harmony with friends and brethren, I accept this ordination. And yesterday we looked at the whole topic of enlightenment around this acceptance verse for the attainment of enlightenment, I accept this ordination. And perhaps we could maybe just stay there just for a little bit. I was trying in that talk to get away from the idea of enlightenment or insight or wisdom as something that you sort of grab, and it's much more that you think in terms of an unfolding, a growing towards enlightenment. And I mentioned in particular the spiral path, and particularly the first links in that path, independence upon dukkha, unsatisfactoriness arises, shraddha, our response, our continuous, even joyous response, you know, to the way enlightenment communicates itself to us, and that being a presence, you know, in our lives, in all of our lives. So one of the things that Sangharakshita, you know, has been very keen to emphasize in all of his teaching, following best Buddhist tradition, is that the Buddhist path is a gradual path. It's a gradual path. It's an unfolding path. It's a you know, we can't do a smash and grab raid on the absolute, as he describes it in enlightenment as experience and non-experience, a sort of a bank robber of the absolute. Attractive though that might sound, it's sort of self-defeating in the end. So we think in the sense of a movement, a growing, you know, so that the light of enlightenment shines, you know, more vividly. And he's described this gradual path in a number of different ways. We have the great stages of the path, which looks at the path in terms of integration, you know, and taking responsibility for our actions, the cultivation of positive and skillful emotion, spiritual vision and spiritual death as the first stage, the first two stages being really crucial in forming a basis for spiritual death, the seeing the fact that we have no permanent and separative selfhood. And then beyond that, the stage of spiritual rebirth, where we're reborn as a Buddha or Bodhisattva, born into that sort of realm, whatever that might mean. And beyond even that, or the expression of all that, is the stage of spontaneous, compassionate activity, doing what needs to be done. And you can do what needs to be done because there's nothing, as it were, self-centered or defiled between you and what needs to be done. Of course, that's a very high level of spiritual practice indeed. It's called the stage of no more learning, spontaneity, and it's really the prerogative of the Buddhas and the very advanced Bodhisattvas. But that's the aim of our practice. So you can see the stages in that way. You can also see the stages in terms of levels of going for refuge. I think, again, this is a unique insight of of Sangha Rakshitas, that going for refuge is a continually deepening movement towards to a greater degree of proximity to and intimacy with the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. A really extraordinary vision. And, you know, he looks at the, you know, he casts his gaze, as it were, at the Buddhist world, at us, and he sees that there is a going for refuge, which is called a cultural, is probably the best translation of it. This is really the going for refuge that is the going for refuge of a born Buddhist, which is, of course, a contradiction in terms. You can't be born a Buddhist. You know, a Buddhist doesn't come out of, a baby doesn't come out of the womb, and presumably unless they're a Nyamanakaya of the Buddha, they don't pop out chanting, Buddhang Sarananga Chami. This doesn't happen. You know, it doesn't work like that. You know, that just because you've got Buddhist parents, it doesn't mean that you're a Buddhist. And I think it's very important to be aware of this, because, I noticed an article recently. It was a very sniffy and critical review by the Observer politics correspondent on Russell Brand's book on revolution. I need to get into what Russell Brand is up to, but Russell Brand, he identifies himself as a Buddhist. I don't know really what that means, but this review was saying, oh well, the left has just dismissed Buddhism and look what's happened in Buddhist countries. And of course it was an extremely ill-informed bit of writing. I did actually feel like writing, but sort of couldn't be bothered, because Buddhist countries are not necessarily Buddhist. In fact, Sangharakshita has said that if it's a Buddhist country, if Buddhism becomes the national religion, it ceases to be the Dharma. It ceases to be Buddhist. It becomes purely cultural. And it's true. You know, some Buddhists, they're Buddhists in name, but the way they behave is not Buddhist. You know, if a Buddhist, you know, is concerned about the destruction of another community, as has happened in Sri Lanka, you know, Buddhist monks blessing warplanes and tanks and so on and so forth, and preaching race hatred against the Tamils, that is a serious departure from the Dharma, an extremely serious departure. Burma, other places, we've seen it happening. And we've got to be really, really clear about this. It's not saying that there aren't Buddhists in countries like that that aren't really doing it. There could well be outstanding individuals who are standing up to that. But we really got to be careful about the sort of, there is a sort of Western kind of orientalist sentimentality about Buddhist countries, which we should be very, very careful of, and realise that what we're doing is not what they're doing, even though the same words might be used. I think this is really crucial. So there's a cultural going for refuge. There might even be equivalent, even in our own, community, on a certain sort of level. You can have people who sort of like being around the Buddhist centre. They might even join in with things, but they haven't as yet seen it as an individual path, something to really, you know, that really brings about spiritual transformation. They like the vibe, they like the atmosphere. Well, that's great, that's fine. That's a start, but it's not the end. Then there's what he calls provisional going for refuge. And he did say when he gave these talks, the initial talk on this, that the terminology is not entirely right, sort of thing. But the provisional going for refuge, he says it's someone who really appreciates the Dharma. They can see the value of commitment, but they're not yet ready to do it. Or they're aspiring to do that. They're gathering themselves together to do that. He thought that this could be, for some people, the going for refuge of a mitra, or in somebody in training for ordination, something like that. Provisional sounds as though it's not really happening. He doesn't mean it like that. It's more like you're in training. That's probably the best way of looking at it, something like that. You're doing it, but you haven't sort of, in a sense, gathered everything together whereby it becomes really central. Or maybe you are doing that and it hasn't quite been seen yet fully and completely by the order. But you're quite comfortable and relaxed about that because you have faith in what you're doing and you have faith in the order. we hope. So that's a sort of provisional going for refuge. And then there's effective going for refuge. And the word effective is, again, slightly problematic, because I'm sure all of you feel that your going for refuge is having effects. You know, and I know it is. I see it. But really, by effective, he means that you've actually entered into formally a spiritual community. You've entered into an order. You're really joined in deep spiritual friendship with others who are going for refuge in that way. And that is seen and witnessed. You've made a public declaration. You've really made a stand. That's what really produces the effects. Very important to understand, though, with effective going for refuge, is that it's dependent on conditions. I mean, one of the things that we're looking for in people who are ready for ordination, yes, I mentioned that business yesterday of a reflection of the transcendental. Of course we want to have that sense, that we can sort of really sense the vividness of your shraddhar, and, you know, there's enough sort of, you know, you're transparent enough for that to be, you know, really kind of activated, and we can, you know, we're really getting it, we're really seeing it, we know you deeply enough to feel that. That's good, that's important, but even that is not enough. One of the things we're also wanting to see is that you've got the nous, the sus, to realise that your spiritual practice, your Dharma life, is dependent on conditions. In other words, it's not an unconditioned going for refuge. You know, and you are setting up the conditions internally through your individual Dharma practice, through your ethics, your meditation, your study, your spiritual friendships, and so on. And externally, you're putting yourself in contexts where your going for refuge is supported, strongly supported, encouraged, kept pure, if you like, by your interaction with spiritual friends. This is really, really important. You don't just have that individual urge, you've also got the intelligence and the integration and the positive emotion to be able to see that it's conditioned. One of the things that I think, you know, can often happen to people, and it happens to all the members, is that people forget how conditional their Dharma life is. You know, we can really easily feel, oh, I've got this sorted and sussed. This is really part of me. And you see people putting themselves in conditions, or not putting themselves in conditions, for example, not going on retreat regularly, and so on, and it wanes. I mean, a number of times I've had order members, we've had the experience of order members coming on retreats with us, and it usually takes a day or two, and they say, oh, I'm remembering why I'm an order member, why I'm a Dharmachari. I've forgotten what it really means. And you say, well, when was the last time on your retreat? And they scratch their head, oh, a year ago? 2 years ago? And you do the math, as the Americans say, you know, add up the sums. You know, there's a reason why you've lost touch with, you know, with it. So effective going for refuge is a conditional going for refuge. You're putting in the effort, you're putting in the, and you've got the intelligence, you know, and the wisdom to work out the conditions that you need. And this is what we're looking for, you know, in those of you that are training. We really want to see this sort of thing going on, just to give you a bit of a tip. But it's that effective going for refuge that is witnessed at the time of ordination. That makes you a Dharmachari. But of course, that's not the end. Again, this is a really important point. It's so easy to feel. People can feel that they're ordained, they've made it, and they can stop making effort. The effort that they made before ordination. Because before ordination, there is a kind of goal to aim for. There's something sort of tangible, you know, before you, that you can aim for. You get a lot of attention before ordination. You get a bit less after, interestingly enough. You know, we tend to think, all right, off you go, sort of thing. Swim in the order, so to speak. But, you know, though there's loads available for order members if they would avail themselves of it. But there is something beyond effective going for refuge, and that's the real going for refuge. This is when going for refuge becomes, well, to some extent, unconditioned. It means you've entered the stream. The going for refuge is going to be going on whatever the conditions. Whatever the conditions, there's going to be something that's moving along in the direction of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Your Shraddha, the ground of your Shraddha, is not dependent on anything external. You've become independent of the teacher in that sense, not in the sense that you reject the teacher. You actually have increased faith and gratitude in the teacher. But it's not sort of dependent on the externals. There's something flowing along, regardless of what happens to you. And when I say regardless of what happens to you, I mean, you know, the threat of violence, illness, death, all those things. There's something that will just keep going for refuge through it all. It's very important, I think, if we talk about this area of stream entry and the real going for refuge, it's got to be tested. There's a bit of a fashion at the moment in some circles for people to declare their stream entry or their irreversibility or whatever it might be. But I was asking somebody about this recently. I said, well, how do you test it? And they were a bit puzzled. I said, well, it's got to be tested, isn't it? You only know if it's really happening if you're in situations which are really challenging. Do you carry on being ethical? Do you carry on being positive? You know, when you're in a really serious situation. But anyway, real going for refuge. It is important to aim for it. It's important in one's Dharma life to keep setting up the conditions to the point where it becomes irreversible, where you can't turn back. Remember years ago, Bhante, there was an older member in India named Mahadharmavir. He was an Anagarika, a very old man who'd come to the Dharma, been ordained, and very, very inspired. But he was getting very old, and he decided on a retreat, without telling anybody, to burn himself to death. A friend of mine was there, and a Western Order member was there, and he woke up, and a couple of friends of mine, they saw this, something was on fire, and they ran out, and it was him. He'd poured kerosene on himself, he'd set himself alight, and left a message saying he didn't want to be dependent on other people, didn't want to be a burden, and he said this was his own action. I mean, it was a very, well, sort of serious and tragic thing. Nobody made him feel like that. It was just his own act. And Bhante was deeply moved by this because Mahadharmavir was incredibly devoted to Bhante. He hadn't had a lot of personal communication with Bhante, but like a lot of our Indian order members, especially older Indian order members, they don't need very much connection to feel this intense love and faith and devotion. And it's the real thing, believe me. It's very, very strong. Very direct, sort of unmediated in a way. I've witnessed it myself. Bhante wrote a very long poem about this called The Caves of Bhaja. There's he entered this sort of poetic mood and, you know, moved by this particular event. And a friend of mine was telling me that Bhante was very, very reflective about this, very moved by what had happened and, you know, sobered, I think. There was a very sober mood around the community. And Bhante was sitting one day at dinner or at lunch or something, and he said, you know, I can't imagine Mahadharmavira not finding the Dharma again. He will find the Dharma again. I can't imagine him not being without the Dharma. The Dharma was so strong in him. Then Bhante paused and said, perhaps that's stream entry. You know, finding the Dharma again, you know, through it all. Perhaps that's stream entry. It was a question. You know, so sometimes it's the strength particularly of it is the strength of the Shraddha. It's said of a stream entrant, they have unshakable Shraddha in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha and in their and in their teachers, unshakable faith, because they've really seen the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as they are. So yes, we need to aim for this. We need to deepen and deepen and deepen our Dharmacharya, going over it and over it until it becomes real, till it's going on, as it were, spontaneously. But beyond that, there is the ultimate going for refuge, which Bhante said, in a sense, isn't a going for refuge at all. This is the refuge, the going for refuge of the Buddha himself. He is the refuge. He is that unshakable, indestructible state of Buddhahood. So we're back at enlightenment. But it's a path. It's a path from where we are now right the way through. You know, we need to have that sort of feeling that where we are now is in relationship to these other levels. There's even another level, which isn't a level at all. This is even more mysterious. This is what Sangharakshita calls the cosmic going for refuge. And he just said when he first talked about this, he said, well, when you look at life, when you look at evolution, what you see is a movement, you know, which finds its culmination in the self-conscious human being. And he says, in a sense, and he said, I know this is impossibly poetic, in a sense, everything is going for refuge. We become conscious of it. In some way or other, there's a movement in the direction of enlightenment itself throughout the whole of nature. Wow. As he says, impossibly poetic as it may seem. He said, and then he just said, but this is in fact what one sees. Yeah, this is in fact what one sees. Well, okay, I'm fine with that. So in one place he also says, so going for refuge, the going for refuge that we are doing is a key to the mystery of existence itself, of all existence. It actually brings us into greater empathy with the whole of life, with each and every living being. That's what should be going on with our going for refuge. If we're feeling, you know, completely separated from everything in an alienated way, something's wrong. Something's wrong. You know, we need to be becoming more and more empathic, you know, with all life as we deepen and deepen in our Dharmacharya. So this brings us then to, you know, talking like this, to the last of the acceptance verses. For the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. We are going for refuge for the benefit of all beings. It's not simply about our own personal, individual, spiritual development. In fact, if we just conceive of it in those terms, we won't be developing. We won't be developing, not spiritually, not on the Buddhist path. Until we actually start opening out to others, our Dharma life is really psychological in the sense that it's happening within the privacy of our own consciousness, our own mind. You know, you might have fantastic meditations, you might have wonderful experiences, you know, all sorts of things going on. But unless there is something happening which is transforming the whole way in which you behave in relation to other people, it's not Dharma life. It's not spiritual life. It's not the Dharmacharya. You know, it's very, very interesting, isn't it? In so many places in the Buddhist tradition, they speak of the first stage of the path as dana, as generosity. The first, you know, on the Bodhisattva path, after the arising of the great Bodhicitta, which is another way of talking about going for refuge, the first thing that happens is generosity. Is an opening out to others. If you have genuinely started to soften and see through your separative selfhood, if you've really done that, what that looks like is generosity, is kindness, is courtesy, is consideration. So we need to look at this. We need to look at in what way can our ordination, our dharmacharya, be for the benefit of all beings. We need to have a bit of a look at that. What does that actually look like? I mean, all beings is a big phrase. It's only a few words, isn't it? But all beings is a lot of beings. The thing is, we've got to start with the beings on our doorstep. The beings that are around us. The beings we live with. The beings we work with. The beings we practice the Dharma with. That's where it all begins. Sometimes, people can get very, very excited about saving the world, changing the world, doing something for the world. And then you look at their actual relationships with people and you see that they're a bit of a mess. And you have to ask yourself, well, hang on, what's going on here? In other words, all beings or all life is an abstraction. It's an abstraction. It's not about real people. You have to start with the real people that are around you if you're going to benefit all beings. You really do have to start with, your family and your neighbours. Charity really does begin at home. And I think, again, that's very, very important because, again, I think there can be, because of technology and, mass media and this sort of thing, for people to get very, very bothered about what's going on in the world, but they're not actually doing enough for the people around them on their doorstep. Because that's more difficult, that's more problematic, that's harder to be in relationship to the actual beings around you. So how are we going to benefit all beings? What's the main benefit of a dharmachari to all beings? Very often when we have these sorts of discussions, things like the whole language of love and compassion for all beings, isn't far away, and sort of saving all beings and all that sort of rhetoric and all that sort of language. But we've really got to look at this. I do want to go into this word compassion, because it's one of those words that, again, trots off the tongue. I do it pretty regularly. And we say enlightenment is the fullness of wisdom and compassion. But I must admit, I'm not comfortable with the word compassion. I'm not comfortable with it. I'm not comfortable with it because, I think compassion is a very high order, real compassionate activity, really alleviating the suffering of others, which is what compassion means. That's a very, very tall order. Obviously, there's the very, very practical things that, you can do, and which many people do, particularly in the caring, professions and so on, and, how wonderful it is that we have a National Health Service and, things like that, and still, a reasonable, compared with some countries, a reasonable level of social care, no matter what criticisms one might have. Amazing, having, been treated by the National Health Service. I'm really grateful to nurses and doctors and, all the rest of it. I really am. And seeing the way my mother is treated in her care home and so on. Enormously grateful that people do that. And, of quite a high order sometimes. I know there are horror stories, but I've seen some really good things. In teachers and, all the rest of it, social workers and so on and so forth. I'm in touch with people in our movement who do all these things, and I find it very, it's vocational. It isn't just a career. There's a real feeling for working, with people, working to alleviate suffering, whatever the demands. So I really admire that. I think the word compassion, though, can in people's minds elicit, a lot of sentimentality and a lot of, gets confused with pity, where we sort of almost have this vicarious feeling, sort of slightly sad at the sorrows of the world, or even very sad. Well, that's masturbation. That is self-indulgent. That's not on. And I think we've really got to watch that, you know, in our Buddhist practice, in the Metta Bhavana, sort of sitting there at the end of the Metta Bhavana, contemplating the sufferings of the world, so you just get off on it and feel how great you are. You know, that is really not on. And that isn't what Buddhist compassion really is. In a sense, I think it's probably better to forget the word compassion. It's much better. And originally in the Buddhist tradition, there was much more emphasis on metta, on loving kindness, you know, on really strong, friendly love. Compassion happens. Compassion is an action when your love for people becomes action to alleviate suffering. So in some ways it would be better not to talk about compassion, not to even try to feel it, but instead to just feel love, very, very strongly develop love. And when you encounter difficulty, wherever it is, you act. You know, compassion is an action, as indeed love is, you know, an action. So we've really got to watch a kind of Buddhist, you know, sentimentality and an ego hijacking of terms like compassion and so on. I think also with the word compassion, people, you know, it can sometimes come up on retreats where we get a bit of, you know, sometimes we can get it in the ear, you know, in the order, like, well, why aren't you doing enough more, you know, compassionate, engaged, you know, Buddhism? You know, why aren't you really doing lots and lots of environmental work and, you know, feeding the hungry and housing the homeless and so on and so forth? And one of the things I think, you know, in discussions about that, one of the things I've discovered in people is that can be an expression of not enough faith, or even no real faith, in the power of the Dharma, in the power of the Dharma to transform. Again, I think if you're called to do those, you know, that direct action, you know, social work, go for it, do it. Do it as a Buddhist and really do it, you know, fully. Or if you encounter situations like that, go for it. But what it mustn't be is a way of thinking that kind of work is superior to the work of communicating the Dharma. The work of communicating the Dharma. Or that the work of communicating the Dharma is a sort of luxury item. That the real work is the hands-on social work. And in a way, you know, teaching the Dharma is just because you're not capable of doing all that sort of social work. You know, that it's a sort of second best. I had an experience of this on an ordination retreat. And we were studying a Perfection of Wisdom text where it defined the Bodhisattva as a great thinker, a great teacher, as someone who cuts off the wrong views in others and reveals wisdom. And the guys in the group were really puzzled. You know, well, what, why is this a Bodhisattva? And I said, well, why isn't it a Bodhisattva? And what emerged was that their view of the Bodhisattva was that the Bodhisattva was a kind of cosmic social worker. You know, flying around, you know, patching people up, getting them back together so that they can lead a sort of, you know, a good samsaric life. And actually what was underneath that was a lack of faith in the power of the Dharma to transform. And that what they were doing in teaching the Dharma, they weren't valuing it enough. It was a sort of second best, because a few of them had actually got burnt out in their various spheres of social work, and I think they felt sort of a bit guilty about that, that they should have gone on and on and on. And I said, no, don't forget that the gift of the Dharma is greater than all other gifts, according to the Buddha. And, you know, what is meant by that, that the gift of the Dharma is greater than all other gifts, you know, greater than feeding the hungry, greater than giving money to the poor, greater than all those other things, the gift of the Dharma is the greatest. This is what the Buddha says. And what he means by that, not just giving a few Buddhist platitudes in a lecture, you know, and so on. He means giving yourself, giving the Dharma, so that the other person transforms, and so that they can pass it on to others transforming, so that the transformation leading to the liberation and the alleviation of the suffering everywhere in the end. That's why the Dharma is the greatest gift. So I think one of the questions, you know, maybe you could ask yourselves is how, you know, do you take that seriously? After all, after the Buddha was enlightened, presumably he could have done anything. You know, he was an extremely capable man. He came from a warrior community. He was bred to be a king. He could have been a Chakravarti Raja, a wheel-turning righteous monarch that could have unified the nations and made a kind of perfect kind of human realm. He didn't do that. He taught people the Dharma. He taught people the means to liberation. He created a spiritual community. He created something of considerable strength and depth that kind of rolls on. I remember Sangharakshita was told about a meeting he had with some Methodist ministers. This is back in the 70s when we were working on the old fire station in Bethnal Green that became the London Buddhist Centre. And these Methodist ministers were very intrigued about all these young people, you know, working in the East End of London, you know, doing up this place. And they went to see Sangharakshita, went to see Bhante to sort of, you know, find out what was going, how had this happened. And one, in the course of the conversation, they asked the question, well, you're not doing anything for the casualties of society. You're not doing anything for those who are starving, those who are homeless and so on. What about that? And, you know, Sangharakshita acknowledged that, well, we're still a young, you know, order, a young movement. We're still sort of discovering ourselves. But then he said something else. He said, yes, but what we're concerned with primarily are the existential casualties. The existential casualties. There's a lot of attention, probably nowhere near enough, on all sorts of other casualties in society. But there's not a lot of attention on the existential casualties. And there are many existential casualties. In fact, everybody is an existential casualty of life. They haven't realised it yet. You know, who's talking to, who's addressing that dissatisfaction with everything that's on offer? Who's addressing that longing, you know, to live differently, to live for something else? Who's addressing that? Who's talking to that? Who's talking to that, you know, part in others that really wants to connect very, very deeply with other people, to really join together with them in a deep harmony, you know, a different kind of communication, you know, not dependent on power and transactions and, you know, I'll scratch your back, you'll scratch mine, but something open-ended that's characterized by real love and metta and kindness that goes on and on. Who's talking to that? Who's addressing that? Well, you know, hopefully there are many, you know, bodies that do that, but I think every Buddhist center that we have does that. You know, every Buddhist center in that sense is doing social work, because underneath social work is the existential situation that people are in touch with. That's what we're addressing, you know, with the Dharma. So in saying this vow, for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination, you're saying, I'm going to live a Dharmachari life, which isn't just for myself, but it's for the benefit of all. I'm going to live a life which shares the Dharma with others. Yes, I might well do other things as well, but I want people to have the Dharma, because I've recognized that the Dharma is addressing what is deepest in me, what I want the deepest in others to be addressed and drawn out, so that they can develop, so that they can unfold. That's what we're doing, you know, with this. And the Dharma is incredibly powerful. We don't realise, and I'm sure I don't realise, just how powerful the Dharma is as a transforming force. You know, I really think we underestimate it. And I include myself, I include, you know, many, many order members in this. We don't have an idea of just how powerful it is as a force. I mean, I know this from India. I know this from India. I lived in India for many years. I studied the life of Baba Saheb Ambedkar, Dr. Ambedkar, this incredible man, first law minister of India, from what was called an untouchable background. Extraordinary man who saw, who had the insight to see, very, very early on in the uplift of his community, and also for the benefit of the entire nation and all the different communities within it, there needed to be a profound, cultural, mental, spiritual transformation. Only that could underpin social revolution, political revolution. Only that. It's only when the minds of individuals are actually engaged, with the Dhamma, with an ethic, a deep ethic, and they're actually in that training, that you are going to have transformation. That's why he converted to Buddhism, and he wanted that for all of India. Extraordinarily bold, amazing man of intense practicality and pragmatism and rationalism. But he brought about that Dharma revolution. And I've seen it. I've seen people with extremely poor backgrounds, crushed lives, if you like. And there wasn't always material improvement. Certainly not when people converted to the Dharma. In fact, it was the other way. Terrible discrimination for becoming Buddhist. Even more discrimination. But they said, they told me they felt free. And they felt a sense of meaning that they never had before. I saw that so often with friends of mine living in very, very difficult situations. But there was this sense of, we have that word empowerment, don't we? That's used quite a lot. But this is the real thing. This is the real sort of inner, force of the Dharma that they've connected with. So the Dharma can do this, not just in India, in all sorts of places. And we've got to have the sort of boldness and the imagination to really feel that in ourselves and share it proudly, from our real, our real sense of it, really communicate it. So really, I think, really get this in your own mind. Once you're ordained, sometimes people ask the question, what shall I do after ordination? What shall I aim for? Well, you could say aim for stream entry, but that's a bit abstract. Turn yourself into a force for the Dharma. Make yourself a force for the Dharma. You've encountered forces of the Dharma in order members, in your centres, and maybe in other people. Where you've encountered them. You've benefited from that. It's changed your life. It's done something to you. That change in your life has impacted on all your other relationships, I'm sure. Be the same. Be like them. Join with them. Do that. That's what it means. That's what it means to benefit, living beings. There's lots of ways in which one can do that. All sorts of ways. But I think the most important of all is to join together with others and really find a way of giving the Dharma in its fullness to people. In its fullness. It's very, very good what's happening in the world at the moment. There's this great interest in mindfulness for stress and pain relief and all that sort of thing. Well, jolly good. That's really good. But that's only a start. That has some focus. What people need is the Dharma in its fullness. We need to improve the ways we deliver that. We need to deliver that with much greater imagination. But we've also got to realise, really fully realise, how powerful that transformative, the transformative effect of the Dharma is. So yes, it means, yes, giving ourselves. It really means giving ourselves to others. There's lots of ways, we can talk about how to do it. I was going to talk about the Sangrahavastus, the way. But I don't think I will. I don't think I'll do that. I think you can follow all that up. The Sangrahavastus describe the way in which a bodhisattva creates a spiritual community working together for the benefit of the world. You do it through generosity, through kindly speech, what's the next one, Maitridasa? Beneficial activity, which is particularly communicating the Dharma, That was just a test for Maitri Dharma, so I knew it really. That was a fear by me, actually. And then there's an exemplification. You exemplify, you know, the Dharma life. That's a really wonderful set to look at. And it should really be the Sangharavastu. It should really be those of you involved in teams that run classes. You should regularly study the Sangharavastus. Regularly see if you're doing it. There's another teaching. This is part of the teaching of the Bodhisattva's skillful means, the Sangharavastus. There's another teaching called the Pratisamvids, which doesn't get the same airtime as the Sangharavastus, but I just want to mention it because, in a sense, the Sangharavastus, generosity, kindly speech, beneficial activity, exemplification, is the kind of more the sort of loving, compassionate side of skillful means. The Pratisamvids are the more wisdom side, and they're equally important, very important. The first is called Dharma Pratisamvid. And it's the Pratisamvid means something like analytical knowledge, wisdom, if you like. It's a wisdom. So the first is Dharma Pratisamvid. It means that you've got this wisdom, this knowledge of the Dharma. The Dharma in the sense of the that sense of the Dharma that's beyond words that we talked about yesterday. That if you like, the sort of transcendental unity of the Dharma, the oneness, put that in inverted commas, of the Dharma. You see the ekayana, the one way. You really see the centrality of going for refuge, that all Buddhist practice is about that, not as an idea but as a direct apprehension. You know, you've got a real feeling for that. But then there's, you know, and that's informing your communication of the Dharma to others. Then there's Artha Pratisamvid, which is analytical knowledge of meaning. And this is knowing the concepts of the Dharma. It means knowing the Four Noble Truths, knowing Pratichasamutpada, knowing the five spiritual faculties, knowing all the great formulations of the Dharma, but knowing that they're an expression of that deep meaning of the Dharma, that deep wordless meaning. So it means you've got enormous flexibility. You're not confused by the different formulations. You know how they kind of fit together, but you know how they can actually really benefit the particular individuals that you're talking to. So if you're going to be involved in sharing your Dharmacharya, you've got to have these two things down. You've really got to know your Dharma. You've really got to train for that. Then there's analytical knowledge of Nirukti Pratisamvid, which is etymology. Bodhisattvas need to know etymology. What it means, you know the meanings of words. You know the meanings of words, both in their letter and their spirit. So you're using the best possible words for any given situation that express the meaning, that express that deeper truth. You know, you're not misled by words, and you don't mislead people by words. And then finally, there's Pratibhana Pratisamvid, which is analytical knowledge of courage. It's boldness, ready speech. It's finding the right word at the right time, you know, so that people will really be touched and affected. The right word that expresses the exact meaning, both in the letter and the spirit, which expresses the meaning, which expresses the Dharma. So this is a really interesting set of teachings. But I think the basic principle is that in benefiting all beings with the Dharma, it's not just about, you know, having good feelings, you know, being a pleasant person, that's a good start, being courteous, friendly, kindly, all that kind of thing, really welcoming people, going out to people. You've also got to have knowledge and wisdom and understanding. You've really got to know the Dharma. There's another aspect to this Bodhisattva skillful means, which is called the Dharanis. Dharanis are sort of magical formulae in the Mahayana tradition that are given to Bodhisattvas by sort of gods and goddesses, which protect them from Maras and other evil influences. But Sangharakshita's understanding of Dharanis, and this is from a lecture, by the way, called On Being All Things to All Men in the Vimalakirti Nidesha series. He says that the Dharanis represent a touch of the inconceivable. So in our Dharma work, our Dharmacharya work for the benefit of others, there needs to be that magic, that touch of something that you can't pin down, that kind of special flavour or atmosphere that just can't be sort of pinned down. You can't describe it. You can't do a technique or a course for this touch of the inconceivable. You've just got to be open to it. You've just got to be open to it, you know, being there. That special magic that just lights up a Dharma event that really kind of sparks people and, you know, holds them to the Dharma. So this is just a few ways of looking at the way in which we can benefit living beings in our Dharma life. But in the end, really, it's about giving ourselves. You know, it really is about giving ourselves fully to others in everything we do. Giving the Dharma as fully and as completely as we can. It means metaphorically, maybe even literally on occasion, embracing others. Really embracing others. Embracing them with the Dharma. Really drawing them to us. That means opening up to them. That means being wide open. I think Trungpa Rinpoche says somewhere that the Bodhisattva path is the open path. Because you really are opening up. And when you really open up to people through giving them the Dharma, which means giving them yourself, you know, as the community giving itself, sometimes you open up to stuff that you'd rather not have. You'd rather not get involved with. You know, it's like that. You have to bear stuff sometimes, because sometimes in that opening up, people, you know, discharge stuff. You know, and it comes out in relation to you. Sometimes they might have to tell you about their lives. Their very, very difficult lives. Sometimes they react to you. Suddenly, you know, they're actually reacting to the Dharma or even to themselves. But they take it out on you because they don't want to take it out on themselves or their loved ones. But you're the convenient, you know, Dharmachari that they take it out on. Sometimes that happens. And you've got to have the strength, the wisdom, the brilliance, you know, to actually take that and transform that. So it's an open path, you know, the Bodhisattva path. And I think this is really important when we talk about benefiting living beings through our Dharma, through giving the Dharma. It isn't about you know, giving a few lectures, giving a few meditation interviews, leading a few retreats, being a sort of distant mentor figure, you know, just doing a little bit of, you know, twiddling with people and then clearing off, you know, and leaving them to it. That's not the way this works. You know, the Bodhisattva path, the benefiting of beings path, is being a friend, you know, to living beings very, very strongly, really benefiting them with your life and encourage them to live the life with you and with others. That's the only way this is going to work. And I think if we have this, if we have a community giving like this to one another, giving to the world, we can do something. And we are doing something. You know, we can at least have a community where people are friendly to each other. They cooperate with each other. They're in harmony with each other. You know, they're doing something, you know, creative. You know, look at all this wonderful, you know, art that Aloka has produced for us. Well, that's come out of a community working together, practicing together. You know, the Padmaloka didn't just sort of appear out of the Norfolk swamps, you know, self-formed. You know, there's been a lot of, you know, a lot of energy, a lot of heartache, a lot of intensity and attention that's gone into creating an environment where people can, you know, come together to practice the Dharma. I think this is another important point about communicating the Dharma for the benefit of all. The creation of environments. The creation of environments. Places where people can come and come together to practice the Dharma. The creation of institutions. That word institution is, people don't like that word, but institutions are really important. The way in which societies organise themselves is really important. Well, we're trying to do the same with our own community, trying to create, come together in ways. So there's channels in which people from all sorts of walks of life and backgrounds can meet and practice and work together for the benefit of all. This is so important in our Dharma work. You know, we're not benefiting all beings with the occasional sort of Dharma talk. It's something, it's okay. You know, and a little bit of meditation for stress reduction. That's good, it's wonderful. But if we're really gonna do something for the world, it's gotta be a lot more than that. We have to give ourselves. Sangharakshita himself was very inspired, is very inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal. From a very, very young age, he found the Bodhisattva ideal really sustained him. In very, very difficult times sometimes, when he was a young monk, a young bhikshu up in Kalimpong, really trying to do something, you know, bringing people together to practice the Dharma, to work for the Dharma, to, well, sort of revive the Dharma in some respects up in northeast India, and then, you know, trying to do it down the plains with Dr. Ambedkar's followers. Sometimes it was really difficult because there were people who put a lot of obstacles in the way and who were really quite unpleasant to him. And he found turning, you know, to the Bodhisattva ideal. No, this life is for the benefit of others and you just have to take that. That's part of the deal. I think that's what he meant. But you've got something bigger that holds all that, the Bodhisattva ideal. And there's a particular moment in his life when he's up in Kalimpong. It's around the time when he's just about to meet with Dr. Ambedkar and get involved very strongly with the conversion movement to Buddhism from those so-called untouchable communities. And there's a particular experience. A young man comes to stay with him in Kalimpong. And this young man was from an untouchable background, and he told Sangharakshita his life. You know, what he'd been through in his life, what he'd seen in his life, in the villages, in the cities. And Sangharakshita was very, very deeply moved by that conversation, and more or less spontaneously, a poem emerged. I sometimes think of this poem, it's called The Bodhisattva's Reply. He's kind of asking a question of the Bodhisattva. You know, what are you going to do in relation to all this, in relation to all this suffering? How are you going to respond? He's asking the Bodhisattva, but perhaps he's also asking himself, what's he going to do, you know, in relation to the suffering that he's heard about? And of course, the suffering he would have seen himself in India. And, well, I'll read you the poem by way of conclusion. It's a poem. It's not a kind of practical program. So take it as poetry. But this is describing really our Dharmacharya. It ends in a sense with an embrace, the embrace of others, so that all are liberated. This is what we, you know, it really should be the way we're replying as a community, not just ourselves on our own, but as a community, you know, to the sufferings of the world around us. The Bodhisattva's reply. What will you say to those whose lives spring up between custom and circumstance, as weeds between wet stones, whose lives corrupt the flower, warped from the beautiful, refuse and sediment their means of sustenance? What will you say to them? That woman, night after night, must sell her body for bread. This boy with the well-oiled hair, and the innocence dead in his face, must lubricate the obscene bodies of gross old men, and both must be merry all day, for thinking would make them mad. What will you say to them? Those dull-eyed men must tend machines till they become machines, or till they are cogs in the giant wheel of industry, producing the clothes that they cannot wear, and the cellophaned luxury goods they can never hope to buy. What will you say to them? Or these dim shadows, which through the pale gold tropic dawn from the outcast village flit, balancing on their heads baskets to bear away garbage and excrement, hugging the wall for fear of the scorn of their fellow men. What will you say to them? And wasted lines that litter the streets of modern cities, souls like butt ends tossed in the gutter and trampled on, human refuse dumped at the crossroads where civilization and civilization meet to breed the unbeautiful. What will you say to them? I shall say nothing, but only fold in compassion's arms their frailty till it becomes strong with my strength, their limbs bright with my beauty, their souls with my wisdom luminous, or till I have become like them, a seed between wet stones of custom and circumstance.